Zoom in on global affairs with insightful debates and exclusive interviews. This is World Insight.
On today's World Insight, common efforts on climate change with different approaches to the same goal as increasingly extreme weather takes its toll on humanity. Joint climate action in different shapes and sizes, the focus of a panel at the recent WWF Forum for Asia, with guests Andrew Forrest, the founder and executive chairman of Fortescue; Jin Lee Chun, the president and chairman of the board of directors, AIIB; Liu Jianmin, the special Chinese envoy for climate change; and Li Cheng, the president of the Institute of Climate Change and Sustainable Development of Tsinghua University.
President Jin, I know you, from where you are, AIIB, is trying to bring partners together. Tell us more about what you are doing. What are you trying to achieve?
Green armistice implies that two guys were fighting, and all of a sudden, they were choked to death because of the climate change. They said, let us stop fighting. Okay, we deal with climate change. This is my interpretation of green armistice. And to quote Shakespeare, it's important to have the interpretation of the times. Interpretation of the times means, how do you interpret the challenges of the present world? And this is from Coriolanus of Shakespeare's tragedy, indicating when Rome was invaded by the Volscians, how the Romans are going to do. How do you interpret the times? You fight against each other or fight against the common enemy? And it so happens, at the same time, in Chinese history, in Chinese classics, in Zhuzhuan, you know, recording the Warring States period. And there's a saying, everybody knows about that. The brothers are fighting within the household of wars, but they unite in defending outside invaders. So if you talk about political hurdle, it means how do you interpret the political hurdle? It could be a hurdle if you don't see anything which could create problems for you. But if you really, really think this climate change is the biggest threat to human society, I mean, to human society, not to any individual country, then there's no political hurdle to talk about. Now, give you another example. It may not be a very close analogy, but I still want to refer to this because I always want to sell my bank, Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. When President Xi initiated, he would like to create a multilateral development bank in the 21st century to deal with the global issues, connectivity, dealing with regional economic integration. So we tried to invite the Americans, the Japanese, and the Europeans to sit down and to work out an agreement. Of course, for various reasons, US and Japan did not participate. But all of the European countries joined. They did not simply join. They were participating in the negotiation of the Articles Agreement. They were working together to shape the governance. And then, how about the differences between China and European countries? Nothing when they think about connectivity, regional development. So it's the interpretation of times. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, President Jin. What about to our special envoy of climate, Mr. Liu, your understanding of the issue?
For me, it's an interesting question because I follow the climate change negotiation since 1996. So for me, it occupied an important part of my life. I think political hurdles exist since the very beginning of the climate change negotiations. That's why in the convention, we acknowledge that the response to climate change is a common but differential responsibility among member states. Common because climate change is a global issue, where all member states, whether big or small, rich or poor, we have common responsibility. But we also have, between developed countries and developing countries, we also have a differentiated responsibility. That exists. I think when in 1997, we negotiated the Kyoto Protocol for their commitments after 2000, initially we believed that the developed countries as a group, they could agree, they could support each other. definitely we negotiated the commitment for developed countries with a 5% joint 5% reduction between 2008 until 2012, 5% equal. They are going to share. But after a few years of funding, even among developed country parties, they have a difference. They have those political hurdles affecting their cooperation, because during the Bush administration, U.S. withdrew from the Kyoto Protocol. So it just left, I think, the rest of the developed countries to untake their commitments. That's why I think from 1992, when the convention negotiated, until the Paris Agreement agreed in 2015, really political hurdles affecting the overall global response, global action to respond to climate change. That's why I think it'd be really many of the actions delayed. That's why last year in Dubai, when I joined John Kerry in speaking with the Pacific Island Countries Forum, we said this is delayed, not because of one or two countries, that because of the political difference. But Paris Agreement, I think, helped to bring all the countries together with a bottom-up approach, nationally determined contributions. I think it'd be to we all join this global effort. Of course, but since Paris, since 2015, I think there's the common consensus among all the parties to support the Paris goal. But another different political hurdle is emerged, that protectionism. I think it'd be because the economic competition becoming another problem for critics. So that's why I think Paris, after Glasgow, after Dubai, we are all committed to the global goal for carbon neutral around the middle of the century. Of course, different countries have a different target year for carbon neutral. But now it seems that we have to find a way to be how to mobilize the public support to ensure that achieving global new carbon neutrality and not just business of about governments,
right?
Not just business of the enterprises, companies, it's public. Like people start to worry about what if the Republicans are back to the U.S. next November.
Okay.
How about they're going to withdraw again the Paris Agreement, like President Trump did. So if we could have a national support for the Paris Agreement, if we could have national support for global action, I hope even whoever is back for the next president, they could stay in the Paris Agreement.
Talking about informing the public needs to understand the latest development of technologies to enable them to feel empowered to discuss and participate. So on that, I want to go to Andrew. Many abstract terminologies in the reports about the latest technology regarding climate change. Very hard for the public to understand. Where are we? So exactly where are we, Andrew? Can you explain, not using big words?
Yeah, I understand. Okay. No, thank you. I'm not good at big words. So moving from a very poor position a decade or two ago to a sound position now, to a really good position. It takes some courage to say that countries should move beyond fossil fuels, and you'd want to have a very sound technical basis for a recommendation like that. Now, where that recommendation comes from is that the lowest form of energy cost in human history has been renewable energy, and do we now link that renewable energy to the energy when we need it? And the answer to that is yes, of course, otherwise it's wasted energy. If we only make renewables for 75% or for 25% of the time we need it, then the other 75% leaves us without any energy friends. So we're seeing a very rapid change in that. Of course, batteries are getting stronger and stronger. So you have in California for the last 20 days, they've made about 150% too much energy for their system, and they were only able to use 60 to 70% of it because they didn't have the storage. Clearly, if they had the storage for around the last month, all of California would have been zero pollution. And that gives you a very strong message that the world is getting there. And nowhere quicker than China. California is slow compared to China. The huge scale which China's building renewable energy can only be applauded by the world. And I see America saying they're worried about Chinese oversupply of renewable energy. I can tell you for the other 7.5 billion people on the planet, we're really happy to have Chinese oversupply of renewable energy equipment, because that's what's going to save us. Whether or not there's a balance of trade 1 year to the next, that's irrelevant. In the big picture, if we go to our times, Mr. Jin, in the big picture, we've got to be focusing in hard on that.
Having heard from Andrew, I want to go back to Professor Lee also on the issue of technologies. What do you see are some of the common technologies we already have in hand that would really bring some answers to the topic we just discussed?
国际能源组织有一估计，就是我们这个未来所需要的这个脱碳的技术呢。
The International Energy Agency has estimated that 50% of decarbonization technologies we need still require much research and development. These technologies are still in the nascent stage. Though we have cut some carbon emissions, that leaves the difficult part of reducing the rest, which is key to carbon neutrality. A large proportion of renewable energy consumption needs new energy storage systems and new power systems. None of them have had a breakthrough yet. Tsinghua University has worked toward a carbon neutral campus. With cross-seasonal energy storage, summer heat will be stored for use in winter, while the winter cold will be stored for use in the summer. These can improve energy efficiency significantly.
Which technologies from China's perspective are we looking into specifically more in details? You heard a case study coming from Tsinghua University. They're trying to do something on the campus, you know, summer, winter. But what about, generally speaking, which is more suitable for a country like China?
Actually, you know, each country has its own energy and it's also on energy demands for an energy reserve. China is rich in coal, less in oil, and lack gas. That's what I think. But the Chinese government will realize that as the largest coal-producing country and consumption country, that we started to reduce our percentage of coal consumption even many years ago. Well, we're also committed to improving our energy efficiency for the coal consumption. But until now, I think even with efforts, we just reduced from 70% of coal consumption to 56. Still a long way to go. But I think Chinese government realized that. So we mobilized our bean sector and the technology sector to invent others. That's why you see China is a leading country in innovation and manufacturing of the solar and wind equipment.
Go to you, President Jin. So how do you see the gap thing that we are talking about? China is a large emerging economy, but what about the others when you are doing the infrastructures? How is it related to this topic that we are trying to tackle today?
Thank you. We certainly would do our very best to help promote the transition to net zero. But we should understand there is a period for transition. Transition cannot be achieved overnight. And then it comes to technology. I think technology comes in many forms, not one technology. There's no limit to technological advancement. We are limited in our capacity only by the reach of imagination. In Chinese, we say, 没有做不到的，只有想不到的。 Whatever you enjoy today could not be possibly conceived 50, 100 years ago. And Andrew raised the question, how could we solve this energy consumption, fossil fuel, in the shipping industry? And how about aviation? So far, you cannot go without fossil fuel for shipping, industry, and aviation. But I do believe there's a way to handle that. Tim said, there are a couple of things we need to do. First of all, we should not only focus on capture carbon dioxide, reducing the burning of fossil fuel. We should also think about creating more oxygen by absorbing carbon dioxide, which means reforestation. or afforestation. We went to Brazil for the G20 meeting, and I went to Amazon region. Amazon region covers more than 50% of the South America. It's not simply Brazil, okay? Amazon region tropical rainforest provides 1/4 of the whole oxygen in this world. It's huge. And if we can protect forests, for instance, in Asia, in the subtropical areas, and how much oxygen we could produce. Do not think carbon dioxide is evil. It's not. It's very important natural resources. The issue is how you turn these natural resources into very productive, useful things.
You know, one of the things is the shared, so-called shared responsibilities that we see a lot of discussion at the COP meetings, at the climate change summit. But now, to you, from different walks of life, what is that shared responsibility? How that can be done?
Lebedong's remarks about how severe global warming is now becoming, I think it's ringing through all of China. We have a really crazy situation in North America where you've got a bunch of people who it doesn't suit them to believe that global warming is happening, doesn't suit them to believe in the science. However, unfortunately, their people and their livestock are dying from humidity, and that's in front of them. So I think you're going to see self-interest start to lock in here. And when the public at large of both, say, India, China, North America, understand that their people matter and their governments are not moving, they are actually listening to less than 0.1% of the population, which is the fossil fuel sector, and ignoring the interests of the 99, the other 8 billion people, then their positions as leaders will become very untenable, and that will lead to change. But we're going to have to wait for that to happen, because self-interest will rule, sadly, with politicians.
I see. Special Envoy Liu, I know China is working with many developing emerging economies on this shared responsibility issue, trying to seek a solution. Now, what is the latest development since you come to the chair of the Special Envoy of China?
We, in debate with member states, parties decided to initiate process for energy transition. I think that raised the issue not only for the individual government, but for the international community, how we could help developing countries to achieve energy transition. Like for Asian countries, actually, according to IEA, there'd be over 80% of the coal consumed in Asia, including East Asia, Southeast Asia, and South Asia. But, you know, in Asia, not every country had the technology and financial resources for the immediate energy transition. That's why I think the issue would be how we could help. I think that way, that's one of the issues I'm going to discuss with many colleagues, including President Jing of the AIIB, about how we could mobilize the multilateral development banks, how we could mobilize the private sector, how we might mobilize the governments in the region to initiate kind of a program, a project to be in Asia, to be helped. I think that we need to start now. Definitely, we need to start now. I think in all these initiatives that we of course think that we need to really devote more resources for the substitution of the fossil fuels with renewable energy. At the same time, we also have to develop, innovate new technology for the good use of the fossil fuels, including the CO2s. CO2 is not just a pollutant. If you could have good technology, you can make it as a good resource for manufacturing for other materials.
Right.
So that's why I think I expect to be for the future in the next 2 or 3 decades, it'll be member state party really need to cooperate on technology.
Shared responsibility is predicated on the understanding of common challenge. This is the first point. And the responsibility comes to different people in different ways. For instance, I said, we need more forests. I mean, Andrew Forrest, we need more people like you, but we really need more forests. trees, greens, you know. And then the people who live in the tropical rainforest, were they in South America or Asia, they should protect the forest without cutting the trees. But of course, multilateral development banks should help them to make a decent living so that they will not cut the trees. For those countries, European countries, United States, advanced country, they have technology, they have financial resources. You contribute, right? And we multilateral development banks would like to leverage the financial resources to crawl in more private sector. Every day, there are basically $2 or $3 trillion of the US dollars moving around the planet, looking for the landing spot. Why they don't land? Because they're not sure whether the policy environment or regulation environment is good for them to invest. And then the government should work together to create an enabling environment for investments in renewables. So shared responsibility means different things to different people.
Right.
But basically, you have to understand climate change is the clear and a present danger.
How can we have a good division of labor, meaning we all contribute to this, whatever you call value chain, supply chain, and technology chain, so that we don't have to invent the wheel and reinvent the wheel all the time? There needs to be real cooperation. How is that likely to happen according to your latest research on the paper right now?
All of humanity are sitting in the same boat that is sinking. So we all need to make an effort. We need to volunteer, not just rely on being asked. That's why common but differentiated responsibilities matter. In this way, we can work on common goals with different approaches. The developed economies have advanced technologies and rich financial resources, so they can help developing countries besides dealing with their own issues. So developing economies can grow with aid and reduce carbon emission with new technologies. I believe this is what it takes for various parties to work together on the same goal.
There is such a monster responsibility to make green hydrogen of a scale that you can challenge and then defeat the oil and gas sector. But that's where we have to go. And there is enough green hydrogen potential easily in the world by a factor of thousands just from the solar and wind we have. If you were going to say division of labour, I'd say Australia, totally focused in on making green hydrogen, green ammonia, and fuels for the world. I'd say to China, totally focus in on what you're fantastic at, which is making the electrolyzers, the renewable energy generators, be that workshop of the world, and then get that equipment out to the world at the lowest possible cost so they can give you energy back at the lowest possible cost. Division of labour and skills.
I think the monstrosity could be reduced as long as everybody is taking their responsibility. But I want to comment very briefly on the so-called reinventing the wheel. Should we reinvent the wheel? Yes, we should. The wheel the humans made thousands of years ago are not the same wheel as you put on the Mercedes-Benz or on the aircraft. They are different wheels. In reinventing wheel means each and every stage you upgrade your technology. So don't just categorically, you know, rule out reinventing wheel. I would really love to see people can reinvent the wheel, but a better wheel.
For me, my responsibility in the coming years, that be do my best to safeguard the multilateral process. That be we really have a global response with a common but differential responsibilities. I think that be so international cooperation will be key. If that fails, then our global effort will fail to achieve the global carbon neutral by around the middle of the century. We have to safeguard and to advance the international cooperation.
Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your attention. Thank you.
Ever wondered what's actually going on in Africa through the perspective of an African? How are things really going between China and Africa? What's the narrative of this relationship? Well, get a perspective with China-Africa Talk. Hear from African diplomats, entrepreneurs, academics, Chinese natives, and more. Get on our wavelength every week to find out what's real with China-Africa Talk. Find us on your favorite podcast. We'll see you there.